lecture that some of you might ask for your money back, but even although it's too late to do that, because remember, the topic of this course is Mises' epistemology, Mises' theory of knowledge. It would appear that in the lecture title, Ultimate Given Determinism Ethics, only one of these topics, namely Ultimate Given, has to do with the theory of knowledge. So I must confess I'm cheating a little bit, although we'll see that Mises' views on determinism, to some extent, come out of his views on the theory of knowledge. And then in ethics, there is a subject called moral epistemology, meaning that epistemologists who don't practice moral epistemology are doing something morally wrong, but it's a study of how we know ethical judgments, how we know propositions about ethics are true, and this will play quite a role in what I'm going to be talking about, how we know ethical judgments according to what Mises has to say. So even though to some extent I'm veering away from the main topic of the course, I'm not really doing it all that much, as you'll see, I hope. I should say one more preliminary remark. Before we get to the ethics part, some of the material's a bit on the difficult side, so I hope you'll bear with me. This is the first part, two parts of this lecture are a bit harder than some of the other material, so try to just don't worry if you don't get it right away. If you do get it, all the better. Okay, now Mises, as you'll note if you go look at Human Action and the Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science, uses a very interesting phrase, the ultimate given. I think this is a nice phrase. Mises had a gift for sometimes for very interesting phrases like ultimate given or the evenly rotating economy. It's a bit like that John Rawls is like that. He comes up with interesting phrases like the veil of perception, the veil of ignorance, I should say, not veil of perception, veil of ignorance. So just like Rawls, Mises has a very good phrase. Of course, he's a much better writer than Rawls. So what does Mises mean by the ultimate given? This is one of the key concepts in his theory of knowledge. And I want to say that Mises uses the phrase the ultimate given in two different ways. Now, the first of these, I'll talk about kind of a stronger sense of ultimate given. Now, one thing I emphasize throughout this course, probably the dominant theme in the course, is that Mises thinks human beings have to view the world through certain concepts. If we want to understand action, human action, we have to have the concept of action. Having this concept involves various sub-concepts. We have the concept of ends and means. We have all sorts of concepts associated with action. We have to grasp these concepts in order to understand human action. And he also held that having this set of concepts isn't confined to human action. We have to have concepts to understand the world generally. We have to have concepts to understand experience, not just human action. This is, as you know, that recognize, we're just going over the material we've gone over a lot before. And one of the most important of these concepts that we have to have it to understand experience is causality or regularity of experience. Say, in order to make sense of the world, we have to have the notion that certain events follow other events in characteristic ways. If we didn't have a notion of causality, we wouldn't be able to understand experience. At least. So Mises says, and I think it's quite plausible what he says there. He said, in his view, we have to think of every event as caused by a previous event. So because of this, we have to think of, in his view, we have to think of every event as caused by a previous event. We get an example of the ultimate given in this first strong sense that I want to distinguish, which is something, a sort of an idea that we can recognize but we're unable to understand because it doesn't fit our concepts beyond human understanding. We can't, according to him, grasp the concept of creation out of nothing. Suppose we say the entire universe came into existence. There wasn't anything causal event preceding that. He says we wouldn't be able to understand how that's possible. We could see that the idea is meaningless. He isn't saying whatever doesn't fit our concepts is meaningless, but we wouldn't be able to understand how creation out of nothing can take place. We can't really grasp this simply because we use the concept of causality in order to understand experience. The concept of causality is that every event is caused by a previous event. So if something just came into existence out of nothing, he says, well, we really wouldn't be able to understand it. So the ultimate, creation out of nothing is something that is kind of beyond the limits of thought. The ultimate given here, so the limits that our categories impose on us. We can't think beyond these categories. If someone wants to use the notion of creation, you would have to just take it as an unexplained idea. We wouldn't be able to understand it. So as I say, this is an example of this first sense of ultimate given, which is an inherent limit of human thought. Another example that Mises gives is the concept of God. We can't, according to Mises, we wouldn't be able to understand how God acts because, remember, according to him, action implies dissatisfaction. Action implies felt uneasiness. Say, again, to use an example I frequently do, I just took a drink of water because I felt that I wanted a drink of water. I felt that there was something lacking in my state of affairs before I drank the water, namely that I was thirsty. So I wanted a drink of water, and I took that, so that's why I acted. But in the usual concept of God, God is supposed to be perfect, so God wouldn't feel uneasy about anything, would be perfectly satisfied. So Mises said we can't understand the concept of God acting. If God did act, it would have to be action in an entirely different sense than we understand the concept. So it's, again, the notion of God's action is beyond the limits of human thought, so it's an ultimate given in this sense. Now, just as somewhat of a digression, I should mention, I don't myself think this argument about God's action works, but I don't want to get into why I think that. It's maybe in discussion we can, if anyone's interested, I can go into it, but I think it's just, it would introduce some unnecessary complications. My lectures tend to be convoluted enough, so I don't need to go into that. Now, just one clarification. When I said that Mises says, again, creation out of nothing and God's action as examples of things we can't, concepts we can't understand, and use those as examples once we give it. It doesn't follow from what I've said that Mises thought there was a creation out of nothing, or that he believed that there was a God, but that we don't understand how he acts. Whereas I know he didn't believe that, or at least he didn't believe there was the second of these, that there was a God. It's just that those are concepts we're unable to grasp. He's not committed to thinking that there are actually. Okay, good. I'm back. You see, this funny, just when I said about talking about beyond the categories that we can understand, then I went off the air. I guess that I didn't do that deliberately, but it fits in. Now, one thing we might ask is, and this again is sort of a sub-theme I've discussed at various points in the course, is how Mises' ideas relate to Kant's philosophy. Remember, some people take Mises as a very strong Kantian, and other people, such as Ayn Rand, don't like Kant or think that Kant was very harmful to philosophy, think that Kant was wrong to the extent he was a Kantian. And I've been trying to say, well, he was certainly influenced by Kant, but he wasn't committed in what he said to accepting very controversial parts of Kant's philosophy. So the question I want to ask now is, does Mises appeal to the ultimate given in this strong sense that I distinguish in these limits to thought, because they go beyond what are the concepts we need to understand and experience deal with? They seem to violate these concepts. Does Mises' appeal to the ultimate given imply that he's committed to Kant's philosophy? Because remember, Kant said we have certain concepts that we know, the phenomenal world we spoke of, the noumenal world, it's something beyond our concepts. So it seems like there's a parallel with what Mises is saying. Mises is saying, here are these concepts or ideas that go beyond our categories, and Kant says there's a noumenal world that we can't understand. We can only understand the phenomenal world. So what I contend is that this isn't such a strong similarity, because when Mises says there's some things we can't understand, such as how the universe came into existence, if it did come into existence at a particular finite time in the past, this doesn't commit him to saying that there's some world different from the world we know, some sort of noumenal world, different from the world we know. Kant did think that, and since we can't know it, he didn't say all that much about it, but he apparently thought there was some sort of mental world, or something like a mental world, rather than one with matter in it. But Mises isn't committed to thinking of a noumenal world in that sense, or any other sense that I can think of. Now, another difference between Mises and Kant, there's a question here, isn't he skeptical as was Kant regard to anything outside the categories? Oh, but you see, Kant did think there were things outside the categories. He just thought we wouldn't know anything, we couldn't know anything about it. We might have beliefs about it. It means it isn't committed at all to thinking there's something outside the categories. So I think that's the difference. A very good question. So another difference is that Kant says that the a priori concepts that he distinguishes, and also the, what he calls the intuitions of space and time, are necessary conditions for thinking. It's impossible, in a very strong sense, that we could think without the categories that Kant draws, distinguishes, and he has long, complicated proofs that various philosophers have all sorts of theories on how to understand what's called the transcendental deduction of the category, where he's trying to show that these must use these categories in order to think. Now, Mises So Mises doesn't say that, he doesn't rule out that there might be more advanced minds than ours that could have a different set of categories. Now, Kant doesn't think that. Kant does think there could be minds with more power than ours. I specifically believe God certainly exists in his view, or possibly angels exist, but they have what he calls intellectual intuition. They can directly grasp the noumenal world, but it doesn't follow that they're using different categories from our own. They can just apply the categories to things that we can't apply them to. We can only apply the categories to things in space and time, but if there's greater minds in art, they can apply the categories to beyond space and time. If we try to do that, we'll get into all sorts of contradictions, or what Kant calls antinomies. But Kant doesn't say, well, maybe God, or if God exists, has some completely different set of categories. And Mises said, well, maybe there are beings that could have different categories from the ones we use, and he thinks that the ones we have are sometimes suggested those are the ones that are kind of weird. Biology has made it such that we have this set of categories we have to understand experience. So it's a much more relativistic view than Kant has. Now, you might wonder, you know, if Mises said, well, maybe there could be minds with different set of categories, is he contradicting his view where he says he attacks polylogism? Remember, polylogism is the view that there are different people with different logics, say, so-called primitive peoples might not use the same logic as we do, or various people say Marxists say the classes have different logics. There's a proletarian logic and bourgeois logic. Various racists think that different races have different ways of thinking. Mises rejects all that. So is this view, is an attack on polylogism, inconsistent with his saying, well, maybe more advanced or different minds from our own that could have a different set of concepts? And no, I don't think it is inconsistent, because what he's saying is that, in fact, as a matter of fact, all human beings use these categories. But remember, one thing I've mentioned in my first lecture and tried to stress a lot, is that Mises isn't engaged in some kind of vast Cartesian project where he's trying to, say, prove that the world must be a certain way, starting from his own thought. He isn't trying to say, here's this sort of grandiose philosophical claim about the nature of all possible thought. It's a much more limited claim to what's the case in this world and things. In fact, people all do have the same, use the same basic set of categories, and said, if you don't believe that, just try it and see, you'll find it works that way. So it's a much, when you think of me, you think of this kind of very deductive a priori, but he has a, it's a very fact-based view. He's not, you shouldn't think it's trying to, you shouldn't take it in a way where he's trying to make claims for all possible worlds or all possible rational beings. He's very much confined to himself, to actually existing human beings. Now, I distinguish this first sense of the ultimate given, which is the concepts that we have, if we use them, we can't understand them because they in some way go beyond or violate the categories we actually use. I want to distinguish also a second or weaker sense of ultimate given, is that we confront certain questions that in fact we can't answer. And I should say, we have to be careful that we don't want to say that any question we now can't answer. Suppose I say, is the economy going to recover by the end of this year? And I don't know the answer yet. That doesn't make it an ultimate given, even in this weaker sense. What he has in mind is questions that he thinks it's extremely unlikely that we'll be able to answer given our present state of knowledge. So, but it's not ruled out that in principle we could answer these questions, just that, just as things are now, we can't answer these questions, and it's very difficult to see how we'll ever be able to answer them. So that's ultimate given in this weaker second sense. It's not that there's something that goes beyond the categories that we have to use to understand experience. It's just something that, as things are, it's extremely unlikely we'll be able to understand. And the example of an ultimate given in this weaker sense that Mises gives is the causes of human choices. If we want to say something, how is it that we remember from action, we know we have certain we act from certain preferences, we have a scale of preferences, and then we always choose the most highly valued of those preferences. We have certain beliefs about the world, so given our preferences and beliefs, we can understand how we act in particular instances. But if we ask, how is it that we acquire our preferences and beliefs, we might be able to come up with some possibilities, but we can't really come up with causal laws stating how we acquire our preferences about things that bring our actions about. We can't really say how we get our scale of preferences in the sense of, not that we know nothing about it, we can't come up with strict causal laws about it. And the reason we can't is just too complicated to find out, or so Mises thinks. Now, just to say, I missed a question. Ross says, the scope of the a priori categories varied across people. No, not the categories he's concerned with. Everyone uses the same categories of human action. He doesn't think that varies to everyone. It's what could vary is that there could be possibly different minds, he thinks, from the ones human beings have that would have different sets of categories. But human beings, he thinks, do have the same set of categories. That's what he means when he denies polylogism. So, as I say, Mises thinks it's it would just be too complicated for us to come up with causal laws about human choices that really completely explain human choices. Now, I want to raise a question here, is how do we know that human choices have causes? There is a view held by proponents of what's called strong free will that in some cases they don't. A proponent of that view would say, supposing, let's say I'm faced with a certain question like, let's take the famous one Sartre uses, there's someone who's considering, should he fight in the French resistance during World War II, fight against the Nazis, or should he stay home and take care of his sick mother? So some people would say, proponents of what they call, what's called strong free will, would say, all you could say is the person is chosen in a certain way based on his preferences, but that there wasn't any cause of his choice. That's just sort of his choice or his action is a starting point for causal chain. Things happen after that, but his choice doesn't have any causes. That seems like one possible view. But Mises wouldn't accept that because, remember, he says a basic category of our thinking is that we have to view every event as having a cause. So we would have to say, according to him, every choice taken as an event has some cause, or every preference, if you take that as someone preferring, is something taking place, event in the person's mind, that would have to have a cause too, because according to him, we have this basic principle of causality that applies universally. Now, I guess what I'm trying to do in this course is just explain Mises' views rather than argue for or against them. But I do want to note a problem with what he says. Bill has a question. Bill, you're certainly right, the choice depends on the context and subjective evaluation, but just what Mises thinks we can't explain is how we come up with that subjective evaluation. Doesn't think we can have causal laws about this. I see Ross has something on. People could have varying materials in which to apply the concept. I think that's right. So you're right there. If that's what you want by scope, I think you're right. But everyone would have a different range of experience. So in that sense, people would have a somewhat different scope to apply in the categories. So everyone wouldn't be applying the categories to identical experiences in any case. So as I say, the problem I wanted to raise for Mises, doesn't the fact that this view I mentioned before exists, that some people say, certain choices don't have causes, whether you accept that view or not, doesn't the fact that people hold that view show that we don't have to think of our choices as cause? So that's a possible problem. If you're interested in this, then you might want to think about it, Mises come up with a good counter to that. Couldn't say, many people think that they're just mistaken. We do have to think of our choices as cause, and so we then have to show why this other view is confused, if it is. One thing I should say here, Mises is then a determinist in the sense that he thinks that even though we can't understand what the causes of our choices are in the sense of come up with causal laws that explain these choices, is attorneys in that sense, it doesn't follow from his version of determinism that ideas aren't important. It isn't that, according to him, well, ultimately, ideas really don't play an important role in our choices, but certain material factors determine the ideas, say, we choose in a certain way because of our class position rather than what we, or our economic position rather than what ideas we have. So Mises doesn't hold that view at all. He thinks determinism, the view that all events, including human choices, have causes, doesn't imply materialism, which Mises takes to be the view that only non-mental events are causes. So Mises said, and he thinks it's true that some of the causes of our choices are ideas, but he isn't saying ideas don't have any role in explaining human action, just thinks that there are causal laws that explain human actions, just we can't find out what they are because matters are so complicated. So he's a determinist, but he said we can't find out what the causal laws are, so we have to take human choices as an ultimate given. We can't explain it. Remember, if I'm right about these two senses of ultimate given, this is the weaker sense. It's just that it's too complicated for us to figure out. It's not conceptually impossible for us to understand because there's something about the causation of human choices that goes beyond our categories, just we can't figure it out. Now, Anish has already caused a law of domain of ideas. I think Mises would say there are, but we just, insofar as ideas play a role in explaining human action, we just couldn't figure out what they are. Man isn't what he eats. Yes, that was the famous saying of Ludwig Feuerbach. Man is what he eats. And he wrote a book with that title. In German, Man ist, was ist. It's even funnier in German. Now, Mises thinks that if there are causes for our decisions, as he does say this, then in fact, we're not free. We just have to take ourselves as free as, because we can't find out the causes. So if he holds that view, namely that determinism is true and that we're really not free, but we just have to take ourselves as free, the view that determinism is incompatible with free choice or free will is called incompatibilism. There are some people who hold that view with determinists and say, well, we don't have free choice. And there are other incompatibilists who say we do have free choice or free will. And then they say, since free will is incompatible with determinism, we should reject determinism. So this view is called incompatibilism. It says determinism and free will can't both be true. It doesn't say which one is true or even if either of them is true. They could both be false. You could hold that determinism is false and, could you really hold not? I don't think you could hold both. I think you could. Yes, you could, because you could hold. Suppose you held something like it was kind of determinism false. Everything happened randomly, and that wasn't sufficient for free will. So you could hold both are false, but be an incompatibilist and hold they both can't be true. So Anish says, according to Mises, yes, he's thinking we don't really have free choice and kind of a strong sense that we have to take ourselves as being free to act, because we don't know, we can't find out the causal laws of, that determine our choices. So free will is something we just have to accept because of the limitations of our knowledge. Now, there is another view in philosophy that Mises really doesn't discuss, which is called compatibilism. And this view maintains that free will and determinism can both be true. So in this view, the laws of nature, which could include laws of how ideas operate, don't restrict your choice. You might say, well, how is that? How could you hold such a view? And the answer that a compatibilist would give is we shouldn't think of the laws of nature as kind of forcing us to act in a certain way. It's not as if there's some, supposing I, again, I'm giving my famous example, infamous example, take a drink of water. Suppose there were some causal law that said, given certain conditions, I would reach for the water. Of course, compatibilist, that doesn't imply I'm not free to choose to drink the water. It's just that if I had chosen otherwise, if I hadn't reached for the water, some other set of laws would be in effect. So the laws aren't viewed as constraining or forcing you to choose. It's just, according to compatibilist, you can be free in the sense of choosing what you want. It's just you're not choosing the set of laws that's in effect. It's that your law, it's just that if you'd chosen otherwise, there would have been a different set of laws of nature. But that isn't, according to compatibilist, that isn't restricting your choice. But that isn't Mises' view. As I say, you find this a bit difficult. This part a bit difficult, don't worry about it because we're going to go on to something that I hope isn't so difficult. But I think there's a reason I mentioned it's a very interesting, I think a very interesting, important philosophical topic. So I just wanted to bring that out. So just in case you want to go into it further. Now, I now want to go into the ethics and how Mises thinks we know ethical, what Mises thinks, how we come to have knowledge about ethics. Now, remember in praxeology, in the study of action, Mises thinks that all values are subjective. So, as he points out, a person will rank alternatives according to his own preferences. And Mises holds there's no way of rationally assessing these rankings. Suppose I say, I prefer, in fact I do, I prefer vanilla ice cream to chocolate. So there's no way you could say, according to him, well, I'm right to prefer vanilla to chocolate. That's just the way I happen to prefer things. So we can ask whether a means is suitable to attain its ends. That's an objective question. I say, suppose I say I want dessert and I have certain preferences. I say, will having this ice cream cone be something that will satisfy my preferences, given I have this set of preferences? That could be an objective question. And we could also have cases where an end can be a means to a further end. I suppose I say I'm doing certain exercises because I want to build up my strength, and I want to build up my strength so I can go try out for the football team. Of course, fat chance in my case that it would work. But there, we could say, building up my, if the question is it I could say wood building up my strength, which is at the end of my exercising. That's a means to a further end. So I say, I could assess, I could judge, is that a reasonable means to attain this end of going out for the football team, or being selected for the football team? If I reach an ultimate end, an end that wasn't a means to some further end, then I just, for the reasons in praxeology, have to say, that's it. You can't assess that. You could just assess means to an end, but not the end itself. Now, if you take, if you're, I got that right, should be, if you're a value subjectivist in praxeology, I missed that, you don't have to be a value subjectivist in ethics. As I worded it, this sentence violates the law of contradiction, as Bill is a good objectivist, Bill will find out. So you can be a value objectivist in ethics if you're a value subjectivist in praxeology. And I should say this is a different use of objectivist from Rand's philosophy. So certain things are valuable. So I should say Max Scheler, a German philosopher, was influential in the 1920s and 30s. He was a friend of Mises, held this position. I should say Scheler is a very interesting character and kept getting married a number of times. I think on his third, he spent the part of his honeymoon on his third marriage, writing letters to his second wife, telling her she was the only woman he really loved. So he's quite an interesting character. Mises rejected this kind of value objectivism. There are certain things that are just valuable. They say certain, say, states. The second bullet point is on slide 10. Is that right? Yeah, this one, is this the one you want? We can ask whether means is suitable to attain its ends. That's an objective question. Is that the one you want? Oh, okay. The next one is this one. An objectivist about values, hold there some values that people ought to pursue whether they do or not. X is valuable, it's true or false. Yes. Okay. So what this view is, suppose you said something like, what would be an example? Suppose you imagine somebody saying a certain beautiful picture, like let's think of the Mona Lisa. Like, let's suppose we say the Mona Lisa is a beautiful picture according to certain, this would be an example of an aesthetic. Someone held that this was something that was beautiful, even if nobody liked it, somebody would say, no, this is just objectively beautiful, whether you like it or not. Or let's take something more directly in ethics. Let's imagine, say, someone who is, what would be a case, I suppose you said someone, imagine the love of a parent for his or her children, somebody could say that's an objectively valuable state of affairs, even if it isn't valuable in the sense that some people think it's good or rank it on their high on the scale of prevalence. It just is valuable. So it's just like you say certain objects have colors, like this is a yellow colored object. You would say its value is some sort of property of it. So, as I say, Max Scheler writes home some stories about held back view, but Mises didn't accept this. He thought that if you, once you reach these values, preferences that aren't means to further preferences, to further ends, then you can't make judgments. You can't say, well, this is objectively good or bad. It's just people have the preferences. And he also rejected another kind of objectivism. This would hold that certain moral principles or constraints that people have to follow regardless of the ends they have. Supposing someone says it's always wrong to take innocent life, that wouldn't be a judgment about a good state of affairs. It would just be saying this principle is an absolute prohibition regardless of how people feel about it. It doesn't matter what ends you have in this view. There are just certain moral principles that are true in some sort of absolute sense, just as, say, we say, suppose I say, I'm now giving a lecture. That's true regardless of what whether people like it or not. It's the case that I'm now giving a lecture. So a certain type of moral objectivist says there are certain moral principles that are just true. And Mises doesn't accept that. He said, just thinks there people have certain ends, their means to achieve these ends, and the values that they have, but he doesn't think they're either objective values or these objective prescriptions or principles that are true. He doesn't accept that. So I want to compare Mises and Rand. Now Rand thinks that values are objective, but not intrinsic. And remember, intrinsic is just this view that there are certain things that just are valuable, regardless of what people think about them. It's just the case that such and such is valuable. So what Rand said is a value is objective if it's needed to maintain your life. I want to raise a question, is how does this differ from what Mises said? Well, Mises would certainly agree that what you need to, well, let me just see, Danny has a quotation from Theory and History. Let me see. Yes, that's exact. Very good. That's exactly what Mises is saying. He says there's no question of truth or falsity about these values. This is going against the view that there is such a question of truth or falsity. So, as I say, Mises would agree with Rand that it's an object, a matter of fact, it's objective, what you need to maintain your life. So that way they're in agreement. Rand also says, and here I think this would be in agreement with Mises, that the decision to live, again, I should say, boy, I've made a lot of typos in this, should be decision to live is a choice rather than something that's intrinsically valuable. So she isn't saying in her argument, well, human life is intrinsically valuable and certain things are needed to maintain life, so that's why those things are objectively valuable. She says, no, you choose to live, and then what you're needed to live is a matter of fact, it's objective. So that way they seem like they're compatible, but again, it's that you have your end, in her case it's choosing to live, and certain things are means to achieve that end, and what those means are is a matter of fact. So that Mises said, well, you have your end, this is not just how you choose. And then what is a means to an end, to that end, can be rationally assessed. But there are differences because Rand thinks that choosing life is the basis for evaluating all other choices. So in her view, it makes no sense to pursue other values unless you choose life. If you do choose life, your own life is the standard and goal of ethics. But Mises doesn't think this. He thought that final ends weren't subject to objective assessment. So he isn't committed, as she is, to the view that if you don't choose life, then you don't have any basis for doing anything else. I mean, certainly the case that, at least for most things we do, we have to be alive in order to do anything else. But he doesn't think that he isn't committed to thinking that you therefore have to make maintaining your life the primary value. Although we'll see a bit later, there are certain things where he says, where he does seem to get a bit closer to Rand on this, as you'll see from what I say about social cooperation later. Now, as I mentioned, Mises rejected these theories that say certain states or affairs just are valuable, or certain moral rules just tell you what to do. It's just a matter of fact they do. Now, why did he reject those views? Well, his claim was that theories of objective value make arbitrary assertions. What would happen if somebody denies that a value is objective? Suppose someone says, well, you say the Mona Lisa is beautiful regardless of anybody, what anybody thinks about this, but I don't accept that. So how would, in his view, how would you settle such a question? He doesn't think there's any way of answering that. He just thinks that people who make such claims are just making claims that can't be backed up. Now, an objection one could raise here is, well, what if someone claimed that you could show just by reasoning that certain values are objective or that certain ethical rules are required by reason? Remember, Kant's famous categorical imperative purports to do just that. So Mises didn't accept this. He thought that Kant's argument failed. He said he thought when it's a matter of practical reason, reason only enters the picture when an end is specified. Once you specify an end, then you can say, how can you achieve that end? But you can't say that something is demanded by reason as an end. You can't say this reason requires that we accept such and such as an end. So you see, even though Mises has affinities with Kant in epistemology, he didn't in ethics. In ethics, his views were quite un-Kantian. Given Mises' rejection of Kant's argument, where Kant is saying we can show that reason requires us to accept a certain moral law, then he has another criticism to offer of this moral objectivity. He says these theories confront us with demands, such as say, well, you ought to do such and such, but why should we accept these ends? Well, I see there's something in the discussion here. And he suggests that you could fit Rand in within the assessing framework if Rand is choosing life and productivity is ultimately. Yes, I think that's a very good point. You could do that. And as we'll see, there's a, I think Mises does do that to a large extent. I'll get into that a little later. See, I can cram in all my remaining material in the time we have left. Yes, it could be a file, changing the end could be a file. So they say, well, on these views, they say, you ought to do such and such, but why should we? So as Mises takes in, unless we can show it's in our interest to follow the rules, the demand is arbitrary. Suppose I said, here is the rule, everyone should give me all his money. Well, I could think of a reason why I would like that, but I'm supposing and you ask, why should I give you my money? And I say, this is just a requirement, you must do this. So this doesn't seem to make sense. You want to say, well, why is it in my interest to do it? So Mises thinks that these various absolutist or intrinsic objective moral theories are right, that they just tell you, you must do this, but they don't say why we have to. Now, I want to contrast this with a famous article by the Oxford philosopher Harold Pritchard, H.A. Pritchard, called Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake, which came out in the journal Mind in 1912. What he says is it's a mistake to seek a non-moral reason to be moral. He thinks that moral rules make their own direct demand on us. Suppose I say it's wrong to kill innocent people. He, in his view, we just directly grasp that that's wrong. It would be the wrong question to say, well, what's in it for me if I accept such a rule? I should just recognize the force of the moral demand. And Mises, as I say, rejected that view, and he thought that position leads to intolerance, in that supposing someone doesn't accept the same value judgments that you do, if you think your value judgments are directly true in the sense that not just your preferences, but there's some sort of absolute truth, you might think, well, then I'd be justified in suppressing people with all the other views. You wouldn't have to think that, but Mises thinks there's a danger there of intolerance. I should say here, John Stuart Mill was very suspicious of appeal to moral intuitions, where people would say, well, I just see that a particular moral rule is true. We thought that led to intolerance. But moral intuitionism is Pritchard was also moral intuition, but someone who held that we directly grasp the force of morality wouldn't have to be an intuitionist. He wouldn't have to hold that there we don't have general principles that apply. You could just say something like, we directly grasp some sort of general principle, but Mises rejected both views, namely that we directly grasp the force of certain moral intuitions and we directly grasp general principles apart from what's in our own interest. Mises, everything is a matter of what are the ends people have and what are means to achieving. The ends can't be rationally evaluated. You just have to say, I have certain ends, so how can I achieve these ends? Now, if final ends are in this sense objective, this raises a question, what did Mises himself take to be the final end? And his answer was human happiness. Now, this makes him a utilitarian, broadly speaking. Yes, Danny points, yes, I think that's right. Mises would certainly have accepted Hume's law that ought can't be derived from his. And so I say this utilitarian position is also called eudaimonism, from the Greek word eudaimonia, which means happiness or flourishing. So the position that well-being is the ultimate goal of life, and Aristotle and other Greeks were eudaimonists. Mises' brand of utilitarianism, though, is not vulnerable to objections usually raised against standard utilitarianism. One version of utilitarianism says you're trying to maximize happiness. So this leads to the problem of you have to compare interpersonal utility. You have to add up utilities, and you can't do that. So Mises isn't vulnerable to that criticism. His type of utilitarianism doesn't compare or add up interpersonal utility. He also doesn't call for sacrificing some people to promote overall happiness. So you take a famous example. Supposing there's a sheriff faced by a mob of angry people going to go on a rampage and kill a lot of other people. And he realizes that if he hangs an innocent man, this will appease the mob and they won't kill all these people. So a utilitarian in this standard sense might have to say, well, wouldn't it maximize happiness if you didn't hang innocent man? The innocent man wouldn't be very happy to be hanged, but you'd be saving the lives of all these other people the mob would have killed, so maybe you could maximize happiness by sacrificing some people to others. But Mises doesn't, version of utilitarianism isn't vulnerable to examples like that, because his type of utilitarianism is much less demanding than standard utilitarianism. The key point is that social cooperation through peace in the free market is the main way people can advance their ends, whatever their ends might be. Now, an objection you might give is, well, Mises says that peace and social cooperation are the way to you can maximize your ends, regardless of what your ends are. Don't some people's ends come into conflict? What if some people want to dominate others? How can then Mises say that social cooperation will advance people's ends without specifying what these ends are? And what he says there is that people's long-term interests are in harmony. They may have short-term interests that conflict, but their long-term interests are in harmony. In what way is that true? Well, he thinks that almost everyone has an interest in peace and prosperity. So that's the long-term interest he's talking about. So he said, well, we all, or practically everybody, has an interest in long-term interest in peace and prosperity, so that's why there's a harmony of interests, and social cooperation in the free market will advance our long-term interests. Now, Murray Rothbard has an interesting objection to this in Ethics of Liberty. He says, even if Mises is right about harmony in the long run, why should people prefer their long-run interests to their short-run interests? Supposing I think, maybe the free market peace would best advance my long-term interest, but right now I just feel like going out and robbing a bank. Why shouldn't I? So what Mises' answer is to his objection is that he thinks that, in fact, almost everyone does prefer long-run peace and prosperity to other interests. He thinks maybe sometimes as a result of mistaken ideas, people can be diverted from that. But he thinks that, in fact, people do want peace and prosperity. He thinks that one group of people who don't, ascetics, say people who just believe in a very rigorous form of life, a way of living that doesn't emphasize their own well-being, would tend to die out. So the ones that are those of us who are left will have this interest in peace and prosperity. And in chapter 39 of Human Action, he goes further. here he's suggesting that there's a life force that drives people, which he thinks is biologically based. So he thinks people, in fact, are interested in preserving their life. So if this is right, Mises is going beyond, if you want life and peace and prosperity to preserve life, then support the free market and peace. If he said this, this would be what Kant terms a hypothetical imperative, which is saying, if you want X, do Y. If you want peace and prosperity, then establish the free market. So what Mises says is that everyone, or almost everyone, does want life. So therefore, almost everyone has reason to accept his imperative. Now, Kant calls a hypothetical imperative where the antecedent always holds an assertoric imperative. So Mises' claim, then, if you're going by this chapter 39 of Human Action, would be an assertoric imperative, saying, if you want life, do such and such. And in fact, everyone or almost everyone does want life. But his claim isn't a categorical imperative. A categorical imperative would make no reference to condition at all. There wouldn't be any if clause. It would just be saying, do such and such. So if you compare this with Rand's ethics, Rand's ethics requires a choice for life, and it doesn't assume that almost everyone will make this choice. It's just that this choice is the basis for all other values. Mises is going further. He says, everyone does want life, or almost everyone does want life. One final thing I'll mention is where Mises makes a point relevant to ethics, is that he says that praxeology, the study of human action, is value-free. But he thinks the praxeologist can still criticize policy proposal because he can ask, can they achieve the ends of their own advocates? Remember, this is a question that has an objective answer. You can't assess ultimate ends, but you can say, does a certain means achieve the ends? For example, suppose someone says they want price control because they, gives an example, they think the price, of, people think the price of milk is too high, so poor people aren't getting enough milk, so maybe we should have price control, and the poor would be able to afford the milk. He said, well, if you have price control, that would reduce the supply of milk that people want to put on the market, so it won't attain the ends that its proponents want. So you could criticize something, a proposal, that without making a value judgment of your own. Well, I think it's about, we're out of time now, so I think we'll have the rest of the session for questions and comments, refutations, and I want to just conclude by saying I hope in this course, we discussed a lot of views that Mises held. I hope we have been able to show that Mises has very interesting and valuable ideas on many different topics in philosophy. And I want to thank all of you for coming to the course. So we'll have the rest of the time will be for questions. Oh, now Justin said, well, what is, in my opinion, Mises' concept of God? Well, you see, oh, thank you, Danny. Very kind of you to say that. Well, what Mises says is the difficulty for the notion of God's action is that action implies felt uneasiness, but God isn't uneasy about anything because he's perfect. But the problem, I think, with that argument is it isn't strictly speaking that action implies uneasiness about what the condition you're now in. It's that action implies that you prefer the result of your action to what would have been the case had you not acted. So action, really, what you're comparing is not the result of the action with where I am now, but the result of the action with what would be the case if you didn't act. Now, very often, there's not much difference, take it one way or the other, but if you take it in this way, action is what would be the case. You prefer your action to what would be the case if you didn't act, then your action does need not imply any felt uneasiness. I think you can get out of Mises' argument that way. Now, there are various complications to that that I don't want to go into. But now let me see. There's a comment here from there's no pressure to choose. The famous question, can an almighty being, can he achieve something which is immune to later interference? There are answers to that one also. I mean, if the notion of something beyond immune to all later interference is contradictory, then it isn't a limitation on God that he can't achieve that, because omnipotence doesn't So certain things are of value. I don't know why I keep going off. I guess someone doesn't want me to go on, but I'm back. Now, do we have something else? Bill said, Bill points out, Rand says, fig and force are opposite sides of the same coin. That's a very interesting point. I remember, though, although Rand would certainly disagree with this, many people who believe in various religions don't think their views are just a matter of faith. They think there are reasons to accept their views. So it wouldn't. I think Rand tends to have some sort of very broad notion of mysticism where she dumps all religious views, but many religions wouldn't view it that way. Sort of incarnations of God, that would be different. Now Bill, did you mean you want me to give an example of a religion that holds such a view, or that you're about to give an example? I see your example. So you're saying that Islamic fundamentalism couldn't be resolved by, I don't know that Rand would agree with you there, because I think, wouldn't she say that there would be, she would think there are certain arguments against Islamic fundamentalism, so she wouldn't say that in favor of what she considers the correct death. So I think she wouldn't say that would be a case that could only be resolved by force. Now, you might mean by that something like, if someone didn't accept reason, then he would have to resort to force. I see. So faith isn't a base for negotiation. I mean, there might be, say that one people with a certain faith could try to persuade others to adopt to different their faith rather than the one they already had. I mean, we do have notions of religious conversion, so I don't think necessarily two conflicting faiths would have to start fighting. I mean, that would be one thing that could happen. I do not see that happening. Now, Anish says, how to think, if there are these parts of any comprehensive how-to series, well, if they are part of a longer series, it's one that's arisen by spontaneous order. I hadn't planned on this. I haven't seen the movie yet. I'd like to see it. I had a chance to see it last weekend. I'm going to see it with Lou Rockwell, but I couldn't make it. He said that he thought it was better than he thought it would be, but he thought that unless you read the book, he didn't think you'd get a lot of what was going on in the movie. Yes, I think most people haven't liked the movie too much. Well, Mises had certain artists and writers he admired a lot, such as the poet Rilke, who makes frequent quotations of the classics, and he tended to stress the role of the creative genius in the arts. I don't think he wrote extensively on art theory, though. As far as I know, he didn't have all that much to say about him. One thing interesting I'll say, if you look at Vienna in the 1920s and 30s, it was one of the great centers of art, theory of art, and great art historians like Julius von Schlosser, others, one of my teachers, Gerhard Lodner, was a great art historian who studied in Vienna in those times, Hans Zettelmeier. So there was a great deal of interest in art theory in Vienna at the time. So I see that Danny has, as usual, an apt quotation. So then this is in accord with what he's saying in this quotation, is in accord with his views on ethics, where he says there aren't absolute values. Here he's saying, kind of taking a subjective view of beauty is that which pleases. So that's a very good quotation. Now, Leslie asked, could someone hold, let me just get back here. Could someone hold Mises' view saying that observation categorical imperative would be best for everyone in the long term? Well, you could certainly say that, but remember various versions of the categorical imperative. I mean, the categorical imperative, said, the first version said, if you'd act on that rule, that you can rule the universal law. I mean, you could say it could work out that does have a best consequence, but you would be following it for different reasons than the one Kant held. What Kant held is the direct requirement of reason. Let's see, Jerry asked, Herbert Spencer's epistemology, why are Spencer's theories ignored by libertarians? Well, Spencer did have an interesting view of epistemology. I think the reason they're ignored, or to the extent they are, is most people nowadays think of Spencer mainly as a social theorist rather than someone I wrote on metaphysics. He did, of course, write very elaborate treatises on biology and metaphysics, but they haven't worn too well. Perhaps there's more in them than most people think. I knew George Smith very well when he was writing that article. It was written for a Liberty Fund conference. I think if there are aspects of Spencer's epistemology you think are especially valuable, you know, perhaps you could indicate what you think they are. I think Spencer certainly, I'd have to go over what he said. Yes, and Danny said, he also liked Schiller and very frequently quotes from Schiller's play. And Danny points out Mies and Rothbard wrote on Spencer, yes, but they were mainly interested in the social theory. Now let me see, here's another question. Anish says, a question regarding epistemological status of synthetic a priori. Let me see. Let me say it's too involved to ask the question now. Matthew asks an interesting point. He says, the ultimate given, the first sense, make the same claim as Wittgenstein, the sense that something cannot be spoken of. Mises in Ultimate Foundation of Economic Science quotes the Wittgenstein's Tractatus, and quotes, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. He actually quotes that passage, so there is a similarity. I don't think he's committed to the view that what is the ultimate given a nonsense concept, he just says we're not able to understand them. Now, Anish is giving you, I have to study what you say in more detail. Sounds like you have your own worked out views on these matters, but I have to study them before I could give you a comment on that. Is that how it bans? Yes, you can certainly email. I'll be happy to try to answer them if I can, by all means. I'm always glad to hear from my students. Now, let's see, we have a few more. A bit more time. I think what I'm going to do in the RAND courses I have in mind will just go over various areas of your thought. And we'll have weekly quizzes similar to this course. I think Richard is right. Our choice of the term that we have to take, we have to take our choices free because we're unable to figure out what the causes of our choices are. He does say that, if we want to know how we know the praxeology applies to people, he says, just try it and see what happens. But I don't think he's committed to pragmatism in the sense that he's defining truth as what works. He's just saying that what works is very often a good test for what's true. But I don't think he's offering that as a definition of truth as the pragmatist would. I think possibly, he had, I think he you could draw some parallels, I think, possibly. With some of the pragmatists, but I want to see how. I don't think they see one thing. They would emphasize that he wouldn't have as much as, especially say, find in John Dewey, is that thinking takes place in sort of as an outcome of social interaction. They wouldn't have the notion of developing a system by deduction in the way he did. So I think there's somewhat of a difference there. But I think Don Lavoie tried to draw some connections between the pragmatists and good, I'm back. Brian says, Mises said he would be socialist. Yes, and you see, this is a very good question. You said, finally, he would be socialist, he'd produce peace and wealth. Mises did not believe in rights in the strict sense, say, that the Rothbardians would. For him, as a private property, so you have a right to private property, kind of a Lockean labor mixture. He thought that the reason we want private property is that this best promotes peace and prosperity. So for him, it's just a question. The reason we want property is this is what works. You could say, well, that's an affinity with pragmatism. It isn't that people have absolute rights. It's just this works better. So that's why he said, he favored capitalism rather than socialism. It's just a matter of if socialism worked better, then he favored that, but it doesn't. Now let's see. Richard said, well, if we could determine what caused our choices, would constitute a choice down in preference no longer be meaningful? No, I don't think so. It would just be that we know what causes these choices and values. We have certain causal laws, but they wouldn't bypass the choices. They would just explain them. So it wouldn't be as if, well, now we just get rid of the choices. It'd just be there'd be something that would be accounting for them, but you wouldn't be eliminating them. Now, Danny asked how many would choose capitalism or socialism, their impacts on human welfare. I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think one reason, we do favor free societies, that we do think it would work better. I mean, I don't think that's inconsistent with a rights-based view, but I think if someone thought, well, a certain system happens to lead to a human misfortune, but we're committed to it because that's the right thing to do, I think that would involve a person considerable tension. Now, there are socialists who say things like, well, I think Ronald Dworkin's very influential. Legal philosopher said, well, even if, say, incentives with inequality would promote greater overall productivity and prosperity, he still wouldn't favor them because equality imposes certain demands. But I think if you push that too far, it would be a hard position to hold. Let's see. I think you have to distinguish what you meant by pragmatism. I mean, in the sense of interest in what works, that would certainly be taken in a loose sense, that pragmatism. is it more demanding philosophy, so identifying the truth with what works rather than just saying it's a test of what works, although it's controversial exactly what's included in pragmatism. Now, the ontological status of values is a, I think Mises tended to be somewhat of a nominalist about conscious universals. That wasn't a topic he wrote about all that much, but I think he just viewed values as particular preferences. So I think he would be firmer on that than on the status of universals. Now, Errol says, if some omniscient being told you what your next action would be, well, you wouldn't, it says, what mystical force would prohibit you from choosing to do otherwise? Well, it wouldn't be, you wouldn't be prohibited from choosing otherwise, but if the omniscient, if the being's really omniscient, you wouldn't choose otherwise. It wouldn't be that, number one, the omniscient being would be telling you, this is what you're going to choose. It wouldn't be saying, this is what is not, you're choosing this is necessarily true, it's just what in fact you will choose. So, let me see, what's the next one here? Where's Mises on the view that man's actions are determined? We must act. Well, he's not saying we must act as if we're free, we're just saying that's all we, well, I think if you look in the readings on what I said on, you'll get the view there. I don't think it's contradictory because it's just saying all we know is that all we have given to us is the choices that we're acting from choices. He thinks there are general reasons to think that there are causes for the choices, but we can't figure out what they are. Yes, as Danny has, as usual, the app quotations, Mises was somewhat, but as I say, somewhat of a nominalist about classes. Well, I guess we're about out of time, so there's any last comments or remarks? Well, are cigar smokers less rational than cigarette smokers? Well, I remember there was a story, there was a man who read so much about how bad smoking is for your health and gave up reading. Now let's see, Bill has a contribution. What is that? Oh, thanks everybody. Thanks for coming to my course. I hope to see you for some of my future courses. Thanks a lot, everybody. Thank you. Okay.